Sometimes on Saturdays of these week-long retreats, the talk has something to do about returning to the world. It's not that common that the world finds us first. It seems very poignant to me that this is how we're reminded. It has happened a few times that people across the creek, up a hill, someplace on the other side, have their shooting practice that they do. But it's a very realistic reminder of what is in this world that we live in. And that we go back to both a beautiful world and an ugly world. A world of tremendous amount of good and a world with tremendous amount of harm being done. And that this Buddhist practice that we do is not meant to be a avoidance of either one, but rather I hope, a deep recognition, understanding, and witnessing and responding to all that we see that this world is about. So we began the retreat with this quote of the Buddha: wise people of great wisdom do not intend their own affliction, the affliction of others, or the affliction of both. Rather, wise people intend their own welfare, the welfare of others, the welfare of both, and the welfare of the whole world. It is in this way that one is a wise person of great wisdom. And this quote occurs in his teachings that have a list of different stages, maybe, or aspects of Dharma practitioner's life. And it follows a description of how a person becomes liberated. And it's almost as if this is the follow-up, that when a person is liberated, this is what will follow. Not that, but what I just read will be the follow-up. I'm sorry for the shooting, because things like this have happened on retreats and other times, other places. And I know very well that people come from all kinds of backgrounds where something like that is very triggering. It's reminding of maybe experiences people have had. And so it's rather unfortunate that this should happen when we're so sensitive and present here. And I'd like to think that there's no mistakes on retreat. That we're here to really figure out how to meet whatever comes up. And so here we have this as well. And there's another sutta that I think is very interesting. It makes a little bit the same point, or makes it a different way. And this establishes kind of a connection, clearer connection, between the possibility of freedom, possibility of insight, of wisdom, and and living a life in service of others or in care of others. And the two don't have to be seen as being mutually exclusive. In fact, maybe the two should be seen, maybe not quite the same, without being the same, maybe being no different. Is that logical? Maybe not. So the Buddha said, suppose, bhikkhus, there were a lake with water that is transparent, clear, and undisturbed. So maybe you've seen such a lake. Sometimes alpine lakes, the mountain maybe. Sometimes you have tide pools that are beautiful, clear lakes. You know, the water's very clear, you see it at the bottom. So there's a lake with water that is transparent, clear, and undisturbed, where a person with good eyesight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, pot shreds, and also shoals of fish, both moving around and stationary. Why is that the person can see that so clearly? Because the water is undisturbed. So too, a person with an undisturbed mind knows one's own good, the good of others, the good of both, and knows the realization of those ultimate human states characterized by knowledge and vision of the noble ones. So someone who has an undisturbed mind will both know something about liberation, a liberated mind, a liberated heart, and they will know about one's own good, the good of others, and the good of both. And I find this kind of inspiring. Some people are worried that enlightenment, awakening, is going to make them detached from the world, unconnected from the world, uncaring for the world, aloof or somehow disconnected, something like that. And it seems that both these quotes, that this idea is it's actually the opposite. That someone who is awakened, someone who's done the work of having a mind that's undisturbed, which is a synonym for being awakened, a mind that's clear, that they would naturally be concerned for the welfare of self, for others, for both self and others in the whole world. The two aren't held up in opposition, but in this quote are brought together as being maybe not the same, but not different, or as being coming, arising together, and both being present. And how might that work? That's the case. One way it works is that if you're able to get to an undisturbed mind, a clear mind, then we really understand well what harm is, what's not beneficial. Before I practiced, I certainly understood that there was a lot of suffering in the world, and before I did Vipassana practice, I became a Zen priest and as a clear intention to respond to the suffering of the world, which I knew there was plenty. But when I started doing Vipassana practice, what I discovered was the suffering of the world is g- greater than I realized. There's even more. I was kind of almost knocked off my feet when I understood that it was so much exponentially more than I had realized. And the reason why I could realize that was that I could see in the subtlety, the depths of my mind, movements of clinging and suffering that were there in the slightest little movements of thinking and thoughts, and that I had no idea had been there. Little bit the paradox was that I could see that level of suffering at a time when my mind was filled with joy. And this juxtaposition of a joyful mind is able to see the depth of the suffering in me, the subtlety of it. And then the reason I was kind of almost knocked off my feet was then I understood in this world around me that the suffering is so much more than I'd realized. And I'm sure I don't understand the full depth and breadth and what goes on in this world, but to see deep in the human mind, even independent from the things that happen to people that are horrible in this world, even someone who has a comfortable, good life, there's so much suffering in there, so much stress, tension at the roots of it. It's kind of an amazing thing to see. And someone who's gotten down to that part of the mind and become freed of it, emptied it, they know something about the potential we all have for freedom. They know something about how good, how much good there can be in people, how beneficial things can become. It's kind of like, it's kind of like you really know the full potential of happiness and well-being. But it comes with an undisturbed mind. The mind has no disturbance in it. There's another teaching the Buddha gives that goes something like this. He asks a question. He says, if two ox are yoked together, is the one ox hindering the freedom of the other ox? And the right answer is no. What's hindering the freedom of both oxes is the fact that they're tied together. It's the yoke, it's the rope that's they're bound by. And he uses that example then he gives examples of if there's your eye, and there's a thing out there that you see, are you being disturbed by the thing out there? That's what's causing you the suffering? No. It's the rope that's knotted, that's tied between the two. But that rope that's invisible to other people is our attachments, our clinging, our resistance, the ways we get knotted up, entangled with things that we see. And when we get entangled with the things we see, the mind is entangled, the mind is disturbed, the mind is no longer clear. It's been agitated. So what about sounds? Same thing. There are sounds, there's the ear that hears, and then there's the entanglement between it. And this is a classic thing on retreat. Maybe it happened to some of you here in this retreat, but it happened to me on the 3-month retreat at IMS, where there was a man sitting next to me in the hall who seemingly always came in late. And he came in like a lumberjack into the meditation hall. You could hear him walking across the long walking hall on the way in, coming, bang, bang, bang. And then he would plop down with great impression on his seat next to me. And then it was like he must have been out running a marathon, because he would be huffing and puffing and catching his breath for a long time. And then, by the time that settled down, then it was off with the Velcro jacket. So I had 3 months to understand that I was getting entangled in those sounds. And it took a while to see the entanglement, and it took a while before my mind stopped being disturbed by it. Sometimes I even appreciated it because it brought me back. It was like a mindfulness bell. But my mind became undisturbed. So in being undisturbed, there was no rope tying me to the sounds that he was making. In the space between my ears and him, there was an absence. And that absence was absence of my clinging, my entanglement. So the same can be true with all the senses. Seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching. And also the mind door. We get entangled in our own thoughts, entangled in our own feelings and what's inside. And we get disturbed. Sometimes we disturb ourselves quite a bit. And maybe all the disturbance, all the ropes that get formed, all the entanglements that get created, they're all disturbances of the mind. They keep the mind agitated. And as the mind becomes settled or let go of these clinging, it becomes clear, transparent, and undisturbed like a still mountain lake. And this is a fascinating metaphor because I think it is because clearly the water is water. It's something. But it's how the water operates to be transparent with nothing blocking the eyesight to see what's in the water. That's the salient thing, that what's important here. It's almost as if the water is not quite there. But it is there. It's water. It's not like it's the air and we see through the air. So it is with our minds. Our minds can become kind of like it's not there. But we know we have a mind. But it's transparent. It becomes clear, and most important of all, it's possible to become unagitated. Now, when mind gets so empty or quiet or peaceful, it becomes hypersensitive to becoming disturbed. Or maybe, I don't know if that's the best language, hypersensitive, but it becomes, very attuned to what it's like to disturb oneself, to create violence to oneself, to shut oneself down or tighten up again or contract, to do something, movements of the mind, which is, ouch, doesn't feel good. One knows what the movements of the mind can be that harm ourselves. We can see that if we get entangled in the sounds around us, we can see how that is harming ourselves. It doesn't mean that maybe we don't get concerned or think about it or maybe take care of it if it's something that we can take care of. But we can take care of these things without having the mind become disturbed or agitated. And where does that caregiving come from when you look into your mind and you don't see anything because it's transparent? Isn't that pretty cool? it's kind of like this magic show. Right now I'm thinking about Harry Potter, where they go into this little shed and it turns out to be this huge palace or something. You go in this empty mind and there's nothing there to be seen, but then it just comes alive in response to the world around us. And the word response is a very, very choice word. To respond rather than to react. To react is to be entangled, is to be agitated. To respond is a welling up that doesn't have to disturb the quality, the state of the mind. So to know this really well, to know how wonderful, how sweet, how freeing, how happiness it is to have a mind that's free, is to know something about how much people can become, how much welfare, how much benefit, how much goodness, what the greatest good is for human beings. And we become very sensitive about ourselves, disturbing that in ourselves. And so a wise person considers how does not intend harming oneself, because we are sensitive to what that's like. Rather intends how to bring benefit to oneself. But also there's something about that undisturbed, open, clear mind that can be receptive, that can tune into what's happening with other people as well. Perhaps it's empathy, partly. An empathy that can be deeper, because if we know ourselves the depths of what's possible, we've experienced it, then we can understand that part in other people in a deeper way. And so what kind of, we encounter suffering in others, what kind of response arises from that? One thing that clearly will not arise or will not be acted on is anything that disturbs the mind, that creates this violence to our own mind. To be very sensitive to this, and one of the things that will be do violence to oneself is to come with hate, respond with hate, to respond with greed, to respond with confusion and delusion that, you know, that goes on. And it's possible to feel that one is kind of, uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. So at least someone who has become, starting to become free, is very disinclined, or impossible, they say, to act on these painful forces that cause harm. And if just, you know, if the only thing that happened to human beings is they stopped acting on greed, hate, and delusion, if that's all that happened, you know, it's like a small thing. It's not like, you know, doing a lot of good for the world. It would be pretty phenomenal. But in addition, there's other things we can do. We can care for the world. And I find it remarkable that the Buddha didn't say that we should love the world. That kind of language, that, you know, the word love is kind of complicated and messy for us in English. Exactly what it means. And it's easy to get entangled in that concept. And he never really said that we should have compassion for the world. He taught compassion meditation. But that's for meditation. What good is it to do it in meditation? Sit quietly and have compassion. But he never really said you should go out and have compassion for the world. What he did say over and over again, he talked about it much more than compassion, was a word that I translate by the English word care. And there was never any obligation to care for the world, but he has clearly the expectation that someone who is liberated or spiritually mature will care for the world. And maybe the closest he got to kind of instruction people to do this is when he had his first 60 people who were enlightened, the Buddha said, go out for the welfare and wander around the world for the welfare and happiness of humans and gods out of care. It's usually translated as compassion, out of compassion. But the word is not karuna. It's anukampa, which is much broader and richer in meaning than the word compassion, because it doesn't only include being caring for people suffering, it's also caring for people's welfare. People who aren't suffering, you can still care for them. And compassion is fantastic. I love it. I mean, it's been a formative principle of my life. So what I'm about to say is, in that context, compassion is also limited as a caregiving emotion, because the way it's usually presented, compassion is caring for the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it, which is great. But if my friends spend all their time having compassion for me, I would start feeling oppressed. I don't know if I want to be around my friends who are constantly, showering me with compassion. It's kind of a limited relationship then. But I do want to be around my friends who care for me, who have care. With care, I don't feel limited by it. I don't feel like I'm being seen only in a certain way. If they care, then when the circumstance is right, they'll probably have compassion. When I'm having a good time and things are going well, they probably will delight in that, want to support that, see how that can grow. They'd be concerned for my welfare. They want to celebrate it. So the Buddha had this amazing word, anukampa. And I like the English word care because it can have two meanings. It's kind of like a verb where it's to actually care for someone, like a nurse cares for someone. Someone who's sick, we care for them. Someone who is, to actually do the work of caring. And it also means to have concern for, to be considerate for, to be interested in the welfare of someone, to care for them, to think they're important, to respect them, to value them. And I think both those words are so nice to me. Sometimes we have care for people, we're concerned for them and in nice ways, and they're valuable, we value them and care for them. And we care for their welfare and for their suffering. And we offer the care, we do things. We don't just sit in our cushion. We actually get off the cushion and try to do the things that are nice and appropriate. So I find it fascinating that the Buddha really considers this to be an outgrowth of the spiritual maturity. That it's almost like he expected, of course, that's what we'll do. And we see in these quotes that I gave today that with an undisturbed mind, unagitated mind, that then we can see and experience, know, have the knowledge and vision of the noble ones. We can know and feel and see for ourselves what it's like to be free. And we can, and at the same time, we'll know about and understand the welfare of self, the others, and both. And then we can be concerned with it and contemplate it, intend it, work for it. And this idea of self is important, because if we don't know this for ourselves, how can we support other people in that direction? Caring for others is a natural outcome, because we're not so different from others. We're all in it together. And there's no way really of being free and not feeling deeply connected or deeply caring or deeply You know, it's almost as if other people's welfare is our own welfare. The other people's suffering is our own suffering. But the Buddha said also a person is intending the welfare, the benefit, for self and other. And I have no idea what he meant. First it did self, then it did the other, and then it's self and other. So maybe it's a modernism that I have to see it this way, but I see self and others as us as a group, us as a unit, us as a little unit working together. So that there's my welfare, your welfare, and then there's the welfare of us together as a group. I saw that with raising a family, that I was slow to learn about this family thing, being a parent thing. Boy, I somehow didn't get that education at school. But, the natural thing, I think, is when babies are really tiny, who can't do anything for themselves, is to want to do everything for them and make sure they're okay. And that seems good. But then at some point, they can start doing things for themselves. And, you stop wiping their bottom because they can do that. You stop feeding them. They can do that. You stop dressing them because they can do that. You stop bathing them because they can do that. You stop, all these things, right? You let them take over and live their lives. But, I had a tendency to kind of sacrifice myself and really think it's all about the kids and kind of be slow in that transition and learn to let go and let them kind of be free. And then at some point I realized that the family as a whole has its own dynamics, its own needs, its own way of being. And it was actually unhealthy for my son to not understand that he had to be part of the family unit and the family unit's health as a whole. It wasn't all for him, which I think we were, maybe a little bit over, on that side. And hopefully we had a course correction just in time. But he had to learn that he was also a member of the we. There's you and self and other. And that, that has its own needs and dynamics. And so we here, we've been a we, self and other here at the IRC. We've been a community. And as a community as a whole, has a different needs than the individuals. And occasionally, we have to take into account the community needs more than the individual needs. That has to also kind of be a dance and movement around that. And how do we manage that? How do we figure that one out? And so it's possible that after a sitting, that, you really would be a good time to sit and have a cup of tea and sit over the deck and look out and just to really chill. And, it seems like, you deserve it and it's a good time. And you could feel how that would just be like so, such a good thing. And really set you up well for the next sitting. And it's this is like, of course, and we're here to meditate and get enlightened, and, this would really help that project really well. And so, certainly that's what I'm here for. That's what the whole place is supported, is for me to get enlightened. So I'll go get the tea. And we sit there drinking the tea out in the deck in front of the windows where the kitchen is. And after a while we realize, they were working really hard in there. The pot washer's really working hard. Yeah, I imagine it's a little harder because I'm not there doing my shift. But I am going to be enlightened. So the balance of self and other, where do we find ourselves in that, right? So that's maybe a silly example, but, makes the point, I hope, that we have to, sometimes we consider the whole. And then the Buddha said, a wise person considers or intends the welfare for the whole world. And I was so inspired when I saw that there's no boundaries, there's no limit to the us. There's no limit to where our heart can extend out and care for and be touched by and be concerned with. And I'm probably not going to do too much for people in some of the distant places in the world. But I'm inspired by the idea that I can live with a heart that's available or open or, in principle, kind of expansive and inclusive. And I think that's a natural thing to do if we understand the undisturbed mind. Remember I said that between my ear and the sound next to me that I was entangled with, when the entanglement is no longer there, there's nothing there. It's an absence. When between my eyes and what I'm seeing, I'm not entangled with, there's an absence there. When there's a thought that arises, and I'm not entangled with it, there's an absence, there's a gap, there's space there. There's an absence of entanglement. You look into the water, the reason it's clear is that there's an absence of silt, mud in the water, and the absence of agitation of waves and all that. It's just still and quiet and empty. Empty. Empty is one of the best things going. Wow, the absence. There's a strong tendency for human beings to focus on anything that's not absence. You know, we want something, which then there's something we want, something we don't want, something we're concerned about. And that goes away, so the obvious thing to do is just pick up another thing, think about or to want. And another thing, and the mind just goes from one thing to another, one thought to another. Most thoughts that we have are thoughts about something. And chances are that most thoughts we have, there might be some entanglement with those thoughts, some involvement, some kind of being concerned with it. But even if we're not too concerned about it, if we're so focused on the content of a thought or the person we're looking at or the thing that we're hearing, we might not notice the absence that's there at the same time. So as our fixation, preoccupation with things and thoughts and the world and the future and the past quiet down, and we're not so driven to always be wanting and getting and avoiding and planning and remembering and debating and justifying and apologizing and all the stuff the mind does, we might start becoming aware of empty, of the absence of clinging, the absence of compulsivity, the absence of agitation. It might be in degrees, it's not like all or nothing. And I think it's actually healthy not to think it's all or nothing, but to think it's in degrees. Wow. It's possible you actually be quite agitated in the mind, and at the same time, to feel that which is not agitated, that either holds it or under it or at the heart of it, different places it might feel it. Because chances are that you're not clever enough to be 100% clinging all the time. I'm sorry to tell you that. It takes a lot of work to cling and to be actively doing it. But we tend to be preoccupied with our problems, the issues, what's going on, what we want and don't want. But to start tuning in and be aware of that there's actually a lot of absence. There's a lot of things we don't cling to. There's actually a lot of much more empty peace, peaceful empty, than maybe you realize. And it's okay to relax. It's okay to not be so entangled and concerned, going from one thought to the next, one desire to another. It's okay to stop. It's okay to rest. It's okay to have in a certain kind of brilliant, luminous, wonderful, majestic, magnanimous. I want to make sure I have enough adjectives that are hyperbole, so really kind of, absolutely wondrous nothing. Because if I just said it's wonderful, it's good to have nothing, then people will complain. So we have to kind of build it up. But it is pretty wonderful. And it's wonderful to have that peace. And it's wonderful to know that it's not a diminishment of who we are. It's actually an enhancement of who we are. We get to be more ourselves the more empty we are. Because what fills that empty space that diminishes us is all our entanglements, all our fears, all our angers, all the things we're preoccupied with. We actually become less. And if that's what we're used to, it can feel like we're becoming less as we become empty. But take the chance. Become empty. And then there's space for all this goodness to surface. Some of the most beautiful sounds are music. Or maybe some bird sounds. And there's... They need to have empty space to reach us, those sounds. Sounds travel through the empty space. Your loving kindness, compassion, mudita, equanimity, your love, if I'm allowed to use the word, your care, your wisdom, your generosity, your kindness, your patience, all those things can surface in that empty space of the mind, like music. Have no more weight than a note of music, no more shape. And it's possible for those to arise with no entanglement, with no disturbance of the mind. They're just there. But if we feel like we need to prove ourselves or be the right kind of person or justify ourselves or all these things, then it's very unsatisfying because you can't really, if you're not going to get entangled with something, how do you prove that you're good? You have nothing to kind of depend on, just a musical note. So this wisdom that can see our clinging and the absence of clinging, the wisdom that can see that which is suffering and that which is not. The wisdom that can see ourself, our selfing, self preoccupation, and all that's empty space that is not self, that's the wisdom that can see the conditionality of how things arise and pass based on conditions and the steps that kind of give birth to suffering. And the wisdom that can see that empty space of knowing, of the mind, of awareness, which doesn't really seem to play the same game, doesn't seem to have the same kind of conditionality that brings it about. The empty space, the absence, you know. Is absence conditional? Kind of, because you take everything else away, but it's not quite the same thing as conditioned things. The wisdom that can see the Four Noble Truths and see how they point to a deep letting go into a kind of glorious absence. The wisdom that can see what is skillful and not skillful, what is harmful and not harmful, and to really see how by not doing the harmful thing we can settle back into this wonderful space, openness, clarity of mind, of heart. And that we can trust the responsivity of the heart in that space. Partly because we know we're not going to get in trouble. We're not going to cause harm because we can feel how that's really going to do violence to ourselves. I mean, that's pretty phenomenal to have that sensitivity and that care and recognition. And to trust this empty place. We don't have to prove ourselves, apologize for ourselves, explain ourselves. We don't have to be anything. We're allowed to be our glorious self. We're allowed to be our wonderful self. We're allowed to be that wonderful self that doesn't need to have a self. That wonderful being that you are, that can be complete, that is not diminished by anything. That empty space of the mind allows to who you are to be lots of space. There's no limitations to who you are in that empty movement of the mind. But if you go look for yourself in that emptiness, you won't find it. Isn't that great? You won't get in trouble. You look for it, you won't see it. Don't look for it, and it'll respond to the world like music coming up from the depths inside of you. The music of care, caring for our world. And I kind of believe that the deepest wish of the heart is to care for self, for others, for self and others, and for the whole world. And if the mind is undisturbed, is absence of all the entanglements, then we will respond in the way that's appropriate for us and for the others. So to conclude this talk, one of the things I am trying to point to is that is a deep trust in awareness, And that an expression of that deep trust is to love everyone. And so the little saying, little phrase that encapsulates what I'm trying to get across today is trust awareness and love everyone. So you might try the next day or so to be a little bit more attuned to empty, the absence, trusting that as your awareness is there together with, in the middle of, coterminous with empty.